go. People writing to us. They love the show. They love it. The early reviews are in, Tom. They can't get enough of the Tom and Carolee show.
I don't blame them. Right.
Yeah, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. We're all having dinner at Sardi's. Broadway loves us. They love us. They're blurbing all over the place. Here comes that wooden wagon carrying the teeny tiny lady in the pickle jar. Oh, here she comes. Look who's helping, making sure she's okay. It's the man himself. Yeah. Boss.
My father was silent most of the time.
Oh, really?
He was not communicative.
Okay.
I grew up psyching. You know, my father was like ashamed of his family. That was my entire picture of masculinity.
Can we just try singing the song?
Yeah. Well, look out, he's crossing the trunk, driving that wagon.
That's all it takes. Replace Barack Obama with Teeny Tiny and you'd listen in.
I'm on board. Tacoma teacher groups plan the sick out over the COVID-19 safety concerns for the in-person learning. It seems like they want to get everybody vaccinated, not just the teachers, but everybody before they go back. They also want the heating and cooling systems all adjusted. They want to make sure the place is as safe as it can possibly be. How many people are involved in the walkout? I do have some sound on this, Tom.
See, unfortunately, I don't think we've had an update. It's a group.
Yeah, we do have Channel 7 with some of the story. You want to Cairo 7?
Okay, go ahead.
We've learned that more than 100 teachers within Tacoma Public Schools are involved in this new movement of opposition, and they're acting alone. So there's no union involved in this so-called sick out. From talking to these teachers within it, they say their concerns aren't just safety, they're logistical too.
We needed to take a second look at this plan and make sure that parents, families, and students understand what it is that they're signing up for.
With QR codes and Instagram posts, using the hashtag SafeReturnToTacoma, a group of teachers is challenging in-person learning plans by calling in sick. They say next month is too soon to return grades 3rd through 12.
The decision to come back into hybrid is not based on any data that we understand in terms of what is actually best for the students.
A letter addressed to the school board lists their demands as all teachers returning must be vaccinated. Remote learning and teaching is opt-in, opt-out for the remainder of the school year. Staff working in buildings receive retroactive hazard pay and strict enforcement of safety protocol.
Students are not 6 feet apart in my classroom. And in most of our kindergarten, first grade classrooms, they put 20 desks in. And if they're not, they don't have 6 feet. We were told that's okay. It's just a guideline. It's not a hard and fast rule.
The Tacoma Education Association represents 2,000 educators, and it says it has no part in this. Tacoma Public Schools tells us they've got a solid agreement with TEA and that it's, quote, followed all the requirements, recommendations, and guidance of our state and local health departments.
All right. So pretty strict demands before they go back. They want everybody to be vaccinated. So that's pretty much probably kids not going back, I would assume, if those teachers have
John,
right?
I don't. Well, see, that's, I'd like to see how many. So they say about 100 of these teachers were part of this group. I don't know if all 100, walked away today. It was a hybrid day, and they said it was a late start Wednesday, so it didn't really impact the students much, and that's why they chose today. But that's 100 out of 2,000, and it sounds like the union already has an arrangement with the school district. So unless all of a sudden half the teachers decide to join this group of 100, I don't think that's going to stop Tacoma's plans.
Oh, okay. So they will go back. And
We'll have to see. That's what I'm sort of waiting for, is to find out. So today is now wrapping up. How many students, how many teachers did in effect have a sick out? Is that any indication of trouble ahead? But right now, this is like an offshoot group from the union. It's not part of the union at all. So as of now, I think Tacoma parents can assume their students will be you know, back in school sometime next month, I guess, March.
That must be a lot of peer pressure on you, right? Let's say you get 100 people all together and some of them are on. Yeah, I'll go back. You know, I've seen the science, the teacher says, and apparently we're really into science, according to the governor, that you say, well, the CDC and kids give it to you, can't get it to you. They're 7 or 8 years old. I'm going back. Whoa, no. If you go back, what about Mary over here? She's got all sorts of other problems. She's diabetic and this and that. It could kill her. Yeah, maybe you're right. So then you just sort of hold the line. You keep working from home. You don't have to work as many hours. And you just simply hold the line. You're still getting paid. So, you know, don't rock the boat. Is that the case?
You can be a labor organizer, but I'm telling you that 20 to 1, they're outnumbered, at least as of now. You've got the 2,000 union members, and the union has agreed to return. So I think this is like a rebel group within the group of teachers. And maybe they're working on the other teachers saying, yeah, what about these, whoever these 100 are? One thing I did notice in the article was that they said that they didn't know how many teachers would be stepping up, but they knew that there would be somebody from each of the high schools for sure stepping away. And I do think high schools are the most problematic, even the ones that are most forward advancing, acknowledge that the higher grades, the high school grades, the dangers there are more prevalent than the elementary school kids. But right now, John,
I challenge that with facts, and I would say you're better off if the high school kids, you're probably better off if they wanted to wear a mask. They're better off with hygiene, better off separating, better off, you know, playing by the rules, and then also chances of the kids getting it, spreading it, whether or not it ends up killing you or not, or at least making you sick for a little while. You'd have to have the science. But again, the science is what we all are basing all of this on. Or is it just generally a fear that you have to go back and work a full week?
Well, I mean, the teachers already work a full week, John. It's whether they do it from home or they do it in the classroom. So these, I mean, this particular
group of teachers.
I don't know about that, Tom. They claim that they don't have information about whether the HVAC systems are up to date. They think the groupings are too large. I mean, they might have complaints based on science, but I think it just feels a little late in the running since they seem to have already struck a deal with the union, overall union.
Yeah, but so what are they with the teacher? Let's say teachers not going in the classroom for fear of their health, their life. So I guess they're at home quarantining themselves, or are they going into this like virus cesspool known as a grocery store and walking around in there? Or are they going other places? Are they talking to friends? Are they possibly going into somebody's house, or they're just in their house, locked in their house, saving themselves so that they don't die because they could die if they go into the classroom?
Well, listen, I don't know enough about the situation to know if I'd be part of that rebel teachers group or not, but it is a different thing when you're in a classroom with 30 or 20 students, for a 6 hour or 8 hour shift or something. That's a little different than visiting the grocery store, but still it's a controversy.
It is, huh? And that's what we do. Straight down the middle, no opinion, just the straight news. Coca-Cola faces backlash over a seminar. The story broke a couple of days ago. What it seems like what Coca-Cola did was they took from a LinkedIn learning sort of seminar that you could do, and they sent it out to their employees, and then you could sit there at your computer at home if you're working from home, and you take this class. And the class is How to Be Less White, were some of the slides that came up. And I read it. I saw the slides. I know Jacob has them, and I think you got the list in front. I'm like, whoa. I mean, that's the eight things that they told you how not to be white. I was like, that's me. Right, Jacob?
Yes. Yeah, let me pull it up. I know that be less arrogant.
Impossible.
Be less ignorant was one of them as
impossible.
Well.
Impossible.
Yeah. Certain. Less certain.
Okay.
John, you're the very definition of white fragility.
Less oppressive. Defensive. That's another thing you should be less. And and then it switches to be more humble, listen, believe, break with apathy, and break with white solidarity.
Oh, boy. Okay, so they basically what they said, this is how you can be less white. And then you list all the stuff, and you go through this, and then basically if you say you're not a racist, then you are a racist. If you say you're trying not to be a racist, then you admit to be a racist. It's Robin DiAngelo. I think it's her class that was on a LinkedIn thing, so Coca-Cola took it. And now they're trying to say, no, it's not that. But they got to kind of got him, right, Tom? It wasn't coming from Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola got it, had their people watch it, and trying to get people to be less racist. Less white. White equals racist. Because
less white people are racist, I think, is an admirable goal. Now,
all white people are racist, because according to Robin DiAngelo, black people can't be, but white people are by the very nature of who they are. So then she lists all this stuff, how to be less white, right?
Okay.
That's great. I'd like to get a T-shirt that has the list of all the stuff and then say, sorry, I'm white because I am all of the horrible things that are listed on there. So she makes a sweeping generalization about color of people's skin and then attributes particular behavior to that skin color, and that's not described as racist.
Now we're getting sort of off topic, but maybe into a better, deeper topic. But the problem is whenever we're talking about these kinds of things, it's all about nuance, and you are flabbergasted by any suggestion that there's nuance involved. You are
There is no nuance, Tom.
Black and white.
Robin DiAngelo, there's no room for nuance. No room.
Well, the thing is, she's written an entire book called White Fragility.
For the last
20 years, she has been talking about that. And I think you are an embodiment of it. And then you can reject it. And I accept that. But the argument that Coca-Cola, the story in Coca-Cola was, Coca-Cola was using this as part of their diversity program, and they kind of cobbled together some random clips from a LinkedIn thing that Robin DiAngelo put together for this much more elaborate. And if you read her book, it's a much more sophisticated approach to race than you're making it, John. But she does have a basic point that you might disagree with. But anyway, she has said, listen, that's not me. That they put that together without my kind of my hands involved. So she is saying that wasn't approved. And then Coca-Cola says, this was not part of their official diversity training. This was something else, like an ad hoc group. So everyone is backing away from that. So the question is, and I think it's a legitimate question, okay, so why was Coca-Cola doing this? And did they really get caught and now no one's willing to defend it? Or is it something that, you know, it shouldn't have even come to the level of a Coca-Cola to have it done. And that we really don't know.
Okay, but we do know there's a pattern.
Robin DiAngelo has the ability to explain herself. And I think that even though you might end up not agreeing with her, either the premise or the conclusion, that there are a lot of fine tuning that's involved when you're talking about racial relations. Go ahead.
Right.
So, your theory on why this happened.
Here we go. Coca-Cola had to write a check for $192 million.
Okay.
The case was brought before Coca-Cola in 1999. By the time it made it to the judge in 2006, Coke wrote out a gigantic check for $192 million. It then said, We're going to make an enormous change. We're all in now. We're never going to let this happen again. So in 2000, after the case was first brought to Coca-Cola, they said, we're going to hire more black people. So they started for a little while and they did pretty well. And they went from 15% increase in more middle management and more blacks higher up in Coca-Cola. And then guess what happened? Oh, it dropped back down to 5%. They lost them. So then they said, well, what are we doing wrong? Because we certainly don't want to get sued again. So then they started hiring again. So they now have somebody new in charge of equity and diversity who says, we're going back at it. We sort of missed the mark. We fell off, and now we're going to come back in and start hiring more black people in order to get back up. Coca-Cola, Expedia, Microsoft, Robin DiAngelo, or someone else that's a race hustler like this organization comes in, you give me $30,000 and here's what I'll do for you. I will give you the protection that you need. So if somebody comes in and says they want to sue you for racial discrimination, you can say, whoa, hold on a second. We had Robin DiAngelo in here. She's written a book, and she charges $30,000, and she owns four homes, and people love her. And we did all that. So why are you saying we are racially insensitive? We already tried to brainwash everybody. All those no science that proves that this type of diversity training does anything other than possibly make people even more upset with one another. But it gives you the cover your ass that the corporations need. It's the same sort of thing they have us watch those things on how to sexually harass somebody. It's the same exact thing. So you get people like Robin DiAngelo and others come in, and Coca-Cola did it. They brought them in or took that thing off of LinkedIn, and they're able to say, yep, we've covered ourselves, and no one can sue us now.
Yeah, but you conveniently avoided the fact that why did they have to settle $192 million for a lawsuit if they weren't doing something wrong?
1999, Tom. 1999, a bunch of employees at Coca-Cola said that they were being discriminated against.
Yes.
Now, listen, I don't know the case. I just know it's 1999.
Yes.
They brought a case before them, and the judge
years
says
ago,
yes. The judge says, you know what? At this, and now, apparently,
they don't want that to happen again.
Right. So you,
what
are we going to do? Well, let's cover ourselves. We don't want to write another check. We don't want the stock to drop again like it did before.
Well, the thing is,
so
stop being racist. That's what they wanted to do.
You can't, Tom.
Yes, you can.
The bigger problem is you cannot stop somebody from having bias, okay? What you can do is you can write laws to protect. Tom, what science proves that having her come in changes the culture or people's minds? There is absolutely no science that backs it up. I saw a Harvard study that said it doesn't work. But it doesn't matter.
That's not what we're debating, John. The debating is, were they racist in their hiring practices? Yeah, bringing in Robin DiAngelo to tell them that, you know, you should try to work on your anti-racism approach to life isn't the cure-all. The cure-all is probably hiring more diversely, and most corporations are in favor of that, and they're trying to do that. So
they have a real problem, though, because Thomas Sowell did a great study. Said what happens is when they go to hire in college, this is from a black dean, says when we hire somebody that is, you know, a new associate, we have to make sure that this person has the skills to go all the way up as far as they can within the department, because if we don't get the best of the best of the best that actually has that growth, we're in a lot of trouble. So what happens is they end up discriminating against some of the people that are applying that may be black, and they'll hire like a middle, you know, kind of a mediocre white person who it's more easier for them to fire. This is Thomas Sowell's study that was done in corporations and in colleges. By the way, Robin DiAngelo does such a great bit of damage to Jackie Robinson in her book. I'd like you to read that. She gives him no credit. Jackie Robinson gets no credit for what he did. It was the fact that white people allowed him to play. Man, oh man. Don't get me started on Robin DiAngelo.
Well, it's true.
But good job, Coca-Cola.
No, but I mean,
but don't forget,
that would make
I'm
sense.
White. I'm white.
There have been,
so I'm,
there
I'm
Negro
a horrible
leagues,
person.
The Negro leagues were not allowed to be part of the major leagues, and it took the major leagues to change their policy to allow Jackie Robinson to be the first.
Yeah.
He wasn't the first great black player.
He had no skills. Yeah,
he
didn't
had
put
huge
up
skills,
he didn't put
and that's
up,
why
Tom,
he was why he helped break down the color barrier.
My friend Tina is listening to the show. She said, "When as soon as you started bashing Bruce, I turned your show off and went and listened to Bruce Springsteen."
Serves you right, John.
Yeah, I know. By the way, when people like, you don't. When people start talking about, like, you have no idea Bruce is the best, it's like, hey, well, how do you, why are you right or wrong about, like, a person's music or art, right? You can't take that position. It's like, well, I like this and like that, right?
No, I think you can. Here's why I would defend that. My assumption is, based on all of the rave reviews and friends I know who just can't get enough of them, I think there is something to some of these people that rise to the top. They're not just commercial sellouts. There's something to it. And I'm willing to acknowledge that I haven't invested the time and the energy, or maybe I didn't have the initial interest in pursuing them, that I accept the fact that they probably are great musicians or significant songwriters. I mean, I was never into Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan seemed like his freaking god, especially for my generation. I never really got into it, but I accept the fact that he was a significant feature on the musical landscape of the 60s, 70s, 80s, even now.
But you can't fault yourself for not getting into it. What you say is, because if you wanted to,
well,
you would have. It wasn't like you were not
to pass
allowed
judgment,
to.
Though.
You just, right, but you, in order, like, you didn't stop yourself from going to a Bob Dylan. You could have easily had access to a Bob Dylan concert.
Yeah, I went to a Bob Dylan
concert. I had tickets to a Bruce Springsteen. I didn't go. People that do go say he puts on an incredible show, even at the age of like 65. He's still jumping around. And I got
supposed
that
to be
fine.
The greatest. Yeah.
Great. Okay, fine. Same thing. Rolling Stones. Right. Got it. You know, you see the Rolling Stones because I got to see the Rolling Stones. Same sort of thing. But it's not like you were doing other things with your time. There's something else that was more important to you than a Bob Dylan concert or something else. So you know, because you were
but
doing
missing,
that other thing that meant more to you.
I know, but I would acknowledge, let's say there are 100 great things to do in a year, and you did 30 of them, and you missed 70 of them. You just accept, you don't judge the other 70 and say, well, they were crap. You don't judge them. You just say, okay, well,
right.
I thought you were dismissing
no.
Bruce Springsteen as a blowhard.
No,
and
he is a blowhard. He
no
is
count.
A blowhard.
He barely talks.
No, his music, his album, Nebraska, and some of the earlier stuff, got it. Listen, he wishes he had the poetic chops of Tom Waits, but he is who he is. I'm not taking that away. But I want to sit there and listen to him talk to Barack Obama? Sorry, not if they're trying to get me on their demographic. Sorry, I'm out. I don't care about Bruce sitting here listening about that stuff. I do think it's interesting that people have stopped tipping, though. This is a story that's come up in people for a while now. I think what has happened is they're just overly serviced. And by being overly serviced, they are then just tired of having to tip the 15 or 20%, because every time you turn around, it seems like there's somebody there with that little thing. You got to press a little button and give them 15% for something.
Yeah, this is odd. We have a couple of stories. Do you want to talk about the general tipping, or do you want to talk about the Seattle, Las Vegas guy?
Yeah, let's do the Seattle guy.
Okay.
I even have sound on him. So this is the Uber driver that picked the wrong delivery, didn't make any money on it, then realized, you know, I spent all this time driving around, taking up all this gas and everything else. He goes on to talk about it. What's he put it up on, Jacob? What's social media?
I believe it started on TikTok.
Y'all, I wish that people who order Uber Eats or DoorDash understood what it's like to be a driver. Like, I just spent 45 minutes on a delivery and had to pay $3 to bring this person their food because there was no parking, no free parking anywhere near their building, and they refused to come out and meet me. They tipped me $1.50 and Uber paid me $2.50. Like, I got approved 3 times the rent for income in 2 weeks, and I can't. And it doesn't matter that I'm working multiple jobs. Doesn't matter that I barely sleep and can barely afford to feed myself. I'm about to be homeless for the 3rd time since May. And it's all because people don't tip their delivery drivers. Like, how hard is it to throw us $5?
Okay. I don't know.
He's talking to you, John.
Yeah, right. If you're homeless or going to be homeless because people don't tip the drivers. But the Cairo, is it who caught up with? Oh, Q13 caught up with the
driver.
Well,
a week is all it took for that video to change his life. The Seattle native, now living in Las Vegas, was recognized with his Sounders jersey on in that video, as you saw, and caught the Sounders' attention, as you mentioned, with a generous donation.
They sent a $500 donation to my Venmo, I believe. And from there, it just kind of caught on with Sounders fans. And then it started this awesome, like, MLS camaraderie.
And before he knew it, Riley Elliott's video had 3.7 million views on Twitter, along with tens of thousands of likes. In total, shocked the response. He says he's received $50,000 in donations, 15,000 of which he says he gave away in the first 48 hours to other people in need. Now, what he describes next is exactly why he says gig workers need better wages.
When I accepted the order, it had been after about an hour of declining lowball offers, and, you know, spending an hour not doing anything is actually costing me money. So, you know, just out of sheer frustration, I accepted it. And, you know, then to go through the whole thing and end up losing money on it, you know, because I had to pay for parking and the tip didn't cover parking. And, you know, what Uber paid me didn't cover gas and time and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So he's also started a GoFundMe page.
Shouldn't do that anymore.
For other, just, yeah, I knew you'd be sympathetic, Ebenezer Curley. I think it's a great story, but yes, it doesn't solve the economic problems of gig workers or anybody else who's, you know, living on the brink of a homelessness. But I think it really speaks to his character that he made $50,000 in donations, and within 48 hours, I guess they said, he gave away like $15,000 of it to other people in need.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he didn't make $50,000. He didn't earn $50,000. $50,000 was given to him. So when somebody gives you $50,000, listen, if somebody just handed me $50,000,
yeah,
I would gladly give away a whole bunch of it. It's one of these things, when you make money easy,
you needn't have to
give it away easy. But when you got to dig a ditch, dig a ditch in the heat, and you take that thing, you are less likely to have to hand that money over to anybody else.
But to help somebody else?
He gave it $50,000. But that's good for him. Give $50,000 away. But he didn't make it, Tom.
The poor give more away in terms of a percentage of their income than the rest of us.
Do. Yeah.
Because they're very generous. They understand the struggles that other people have. So they're very sympathetic to that, even though they have less money.
Anyway, black. They are religious. They live in the southeast part of the United States. They give away more money than the rich white people that live in San Francisco that are liberal and care more. It's southeastern part of the United States, Mississippi. Poor people in Mississippi give more money away to the church, which then goes to charities. But they are more generous than some liberal living in Boston making far more money than they do.
The point here, John, you're trying to make, the point here is this guy was desperate. He aired his desperation, and people responded. The weird thing is that this launches a whole discussion about tipping. There were a number of restaurants that were moving into the no-tipping era in order to be fair to their staff, the front staff and their back staff and all. And they say that the pandemic has really curbed that because waiters, services, the service industry are having such a hard time of it that they want to allow for tips. The bad thing is that tips are down during the pandemic, which I find baffling because, I mean, I've never tipped so much in my life because I feel I still have my job. I can help the service delivery people that are working out there.
Hi, Teeny. She's chosen a letter today. She's pretty excited about it. Let's get a little bit of mailman. Drop some mailman on me here, but not too much. I'll tell you when to cut it off. Ready? And stop it! Oh, yeah, thanks. All right, Tom, we'll get to the letter of the day, but first let's take care of all the rest.
Okay, we kicked off the show, as we often do, with Hannah and her legislative update. Area code 360 weighs in. Police reform in Seattle happened years ago. This is a waste of time.
Oh, boy. Let's see, 425. I once had a long, honest conversation with a cop, John. His take on police, he says, for after 25 years, you get about a third of the cops real heroes. A third of them, they do good with their job. They're honest police work. A third are also general guys, just kind of, you know, doing the hours, putting in, waiting for the pension kicks in. Neither good nor bad. The last third are people that should never have been given a badge.
And area code 425, thank you, John Curley. This cop's wife appreciates your commentary with regards to mandatory reporting. Good cops don't feel pressure not to report because good cops do what's right. Not to mention, many departments already have policies that address this. Bad legislation.
425 says national numbers, 375 million police contacts with citizens every year. That's 7.2 million every week. How many cases of excessive force do we hear about every year? Does this justify this type of nonsense?
And area code 360, bad statistics. If you consider all the customer contacts in stores, how tiny is the percentage of people who rob the store? Yet we have and support laws against robbing stores.
Clee LM 206, the Clee, it is. That's freaking cool. Good. Thanks, 206. See you in the
And Clee. Yet 206 also says, the Clee? I'm not a Clee LM resident and still think that's stupid.
Didn't say it wasn't stupid. Curly, I'm going to need some spelling on the nickname. One word or two. The Klee or the Klee or the Klee or the Klee.
And then the Klee.
K-L-I-E. The Klee. Yes, that's good.
Mm-hmm. And area code 206. John, I would love to be an invited member to your Kleelum gathering.
You're on the list. Thanks, 206.
Yeah. Anyone with an area code 206, you're invited to John's cabin.
It's going to be a big party this summer. Yeah. Jacob's going to probably throw a big wet blanket on it. Cairo and people drinking, and you can't be held responsible. Screw that. Screw on that, Jacob. Moving on. That,
right. Screw on it, yeah. Okay, John?
Yes. Oh, Johnson & Johnson 206 says, talking about the vaccine, 60% of the time, it works every time.
And funny. Fox Island G at the 253, steepening yield curves crush growth stocks, John. I thought your trading academy taught you that.
I know. I saw that because right now the 10-year treasure is up. I got that. 425, why not use the COVID testing results to find the best areas to set up a pop-up a clinic. Oh, there you go.
That's I think, what that thing is a model after. Mm-hmm. Obama Springsteen podcast, Stan, the fireplace man. Curly, you got it all wrong. Why wouldn't you listen to the Obama and Springsteen podcast? Hell, I have trouble sleeping sometimes.
Thank you, Stan. Funny one. 206. Bruce Snub Brock. He can't remember when they first met the president. Who would have forgotten the first time you met the president? Come on, man.
Eric Code 206. So, Curly, you don't like blowhards? Do you like the ultimate blowhard, Trump?
And now it is time for the letter of the day.
Letter of the day comes from area code 425.
Oh, good.
There's a call holding on line 7 for John Curly from HR regarding his Tracy Taylor hot tub comments. Line 17 for John Curly. Please pick up.
It was subtle. It was subtle. I got a text from Larry in accounting. He's like, get the hot tub.
That's all she wrote.
That's all she wrote.
Didn't write no more.
You didn't notice
it, Tom.
Oh,
I did, and I purposely didn't say anything.